For me? Preacher Barbara Brown Taylor taught me a story from the Zen Buddhist tradition about a disciple who thought that he could improve his chances of enlightenment by seeking it on his own. So he bid farewell to his brothers at the monastery, and he took the ferry across the river, and he went to live high in a cave all by himself. There in that cave, he meditated for 25 years. At the end of those 25 years, he emerged from the cave. He stretched his arms above his head like a man waking from a long sleep. And then he made his way down to the river. Without even pausing to check the temperature of the water first, he stepped out onto the water. And he proceeded to walk across it toward the monastery that he left a quarter of a century ago. Two monks were down at the river doing their laundry. They spotted him. "Who is that?" one of them asked. The other replied, "Oh, that's the old man who spent 25 years meditating in a cave. Now look at him. He can walk on water." "What a pity," the first monk said. "The ferry only costs a quarter." As Christians, we have our own water walking story. It is the disciple Peter who does the walking, and Peter is our focus during this particular season of Lent. I want to thank Gil for preaching last week about Simon Peter's calling and about his own calling as a disciple. I do think that Gil looks an awful lot like Peter. But I also want you to know, I think I look like Peter too. That's the thing about Simon Peter. All of us look like Simon Peter. All of our faces are reflected in this disciple. And that's why he is worth considering. Matthew chapter 14 tells us that Jesus feeds a crowd of 5,000 people, and immediately after feeding that crowd, he sends his disciples to go on ahead of him in a boat across the Sea of Galilee. And far from land, in the wee hours of the morning, while they are on that boat, there is a storm. Now, some versions of the Bible, the NIV is one of those versions, says that this is the fourth watch of the night. And the fourth watch of the night is between the hours of 3 and 6 a.m. And as far as I'm concerned, that is the longest, darkest part of the night. Why is it that my brain can so easily spin into despair during the fourth watch? I don't know why it is, but it's true. It's also true that that fourth watch is right before the dawn. So it's been dark for a while. The disciples are on this boat, in this boat, and there's a storm. They are battered about in the boat by the wind and the waves. You've heard me say it before, but for most of the history of the Christian church, the boat has been a symbol of the faith community. It is a symbol of church. The thought probably has its origins in this very Bible story. 12 disciples, all of them are there together, out on the sea, in a storm, in a boat. Does it sound like church? It should. It should sound like church. That's what we are to be about. And the church as a boat shows up in the architecture of many Christian churches, many sanctuaries that have been constructed. The picture that you see is a sanctuary in Kentucky. It's at the Abbey of Gethsemane. It's where Thomas Merton worshiped. And notice that in this sanctuary, and maybe in many sanctuaries of your memory, the vaulted ceiling becomes like the boat's keel. The area protruding from the front of the altar looks like the bow of a ship. And the central area of a sanctuary where we typically gather and pray and worship in a lot of sanctuaries is referred to as the nave, N-A-V-E. And that is a word that in its Latin origin means ship. We worship in boats. It's no surprise, I don't think, to my husband or to my son. They've been telling me for years that a boat is a great place to be, especially on a Sunday morning. We worship in boats. And I do really, really love what the Spring Creek boat says about us. Look around and see what you think this boat says about who we are. There are no fancy seats. They're all the same. And we have a really great view from our boat. Out these windows over here, the focus is a fallen tree that rises again. New life in every circumstance. We're centered around that. That's who we are. The thing about boats, though, they're not much good on dry land. They have to venture out. They have to get out on the water. And the water, for the biblical mind, is an intimidating place. It is a place of uncertainty, and it is a place of chaos. It's a foreign thought to us. Because in the modern world, we have things like scuba gear and boats with motors and submarines so we can get across the water, we can get underneath the water. The disciples didn't have these things, and they feared what was underneath the water. They feared a storm at sea. They fished, the disciples fished, along the banks of the Sea of Galilee, because they didn't venture across the water by choice. This passage in Matthew chapter 14, it has two reoccurring themes. It's only 12 short verses, but there are two themes that show up in phrases through those 12 short verses, and one of those themes is fear. It shows up four times in this short passage. The disciples are terrified, and at another point, they are so frightened, they scream out. The other theme that shows up repeatedly in this story is that there's a storm at sea. And so the wind is against them. The waves batter the boat that they're in. Preacher Fred Craddock, in a sermon on this passage, said about the water, "Nobody today who jumps off the high dive says, as I dive in, I'm going to be looking out for demons." We don't warn people who are jumping into the water, look out for demons. We don't do that anymore. It's a good point. It kind of made me chuckle all week. We don't think that way about water. The disciples did. We do, however, know what it is to be afraid. We do know fear. And we do know storms in our lives that bring despair. Craddock went on to preach, "I sure do wish that fear could be contained to the water these days, but that's not where fear is at all. Sometimes it seems as though fear is all around me." And this passage reminds me that it's part of life for the disciple. It's not just sunny skies and smooth sailing for those of us who follow Jesus. Storms swirl. They swirl around us, and fear rises up in us. It can be right beneath the surface of life, trying to tell us what to do. You know, it's not a failure on the part of the disciples to find this scene scary, to be afraid. It is a scary scene. The fear is legit. It is, however, from my perspective, a failure on the part of the disciples to think that when life is scary, God is absent. That when life stirs up fear in us, God is not there. God is far away. Because that's not the truth at all. Jesus does not abandon the disciples. Jesus sends the disciples. And then he comes walking on the water toward them. That's totally in character for the Messiah, the one who saves. In the Bible, God walks on waters, tramples on the waves, holds chaos at bay. In the Bible, that's what God does. But because of all the fear in the atmosphere, the disciples don't see it. They don't get it. They think that God is absent. And they say about the figure who is walking toward them, "It's a ghost." Did you catch that? The disciples say, "That's a ghost," because they let their fear inform what they think. They think that Jesus is far away. He couldn't possibly be in the middle of this storm. But God is. God is always in the middle of the storms that we encounter. Jesus says to the disciples, "Take heart," or "show courage," or "be bold." That's in verse 27. And I wondered this week, what's that about? How are they to show courage? I think Peter goes for the gusto. I do. He picks the most difficult, impossible route to be courageous. And I've got to like this about him. Simon Peter makes things harder than they have to be. I do that too. I often make things harder than they have to be. Peter decides, show courage, I'm going to walk on water like God walks on water. It's a pity, right? The ferry only costs a quarter. Peter doesn't have to walk on water. I think that's his own half-baked idea. Is it courageous enough to wait on God? To look for God in the storm? To witness how the wind and the waves are calmed? I think it is. I do. I think that's enough. Jesus also says to Peter, "Why did you doubt?" Which in the original language, in Greek, implies a double stance, like going two different directions at the same time. So what's the distraction for Peter? The text isn't specific about what this double stance is. What's the distraction? How's he going two different ways at the same time? Is he thinking of Jesus, but also distracted by his own ambition? Is he focused on faith, but also full of self-doubt? Is he curious and also afraid? I get all those scenarios. I have been filled with doubt in all those ways. A double stance. I'm not certain about it, what Peter's doubt is all about, but what I am certain about when I read this text is rescue. And the priority of the boat. Peter cries out, "Lord, rescue me." And immediately there is Jesus' hand and there's a boat. Immediately he is rescued. The wind settles down and I imagine that the darkness subsides. And those who are in the boat, they worship. The disciples worship in the boat. They don't wait to get to the other side of the sea, but they worship right there in the boat. What does it mean to worship? I want to tell you that I believe that the primary characteristic of worship is remembering. Remembering who God is and what God does. That's why we gather together to worship. To remember who God is and what God has done. Author and preacher Nadia Bolz-Weber advised, "When you doubt, don't try to do what Jesus would do." Remember those bracelets? Those WWJD bracelets? I had one of those. It was fashionable advice for a period of time. Do what Jesus would do. But Nadia Bolz-Weber says, "Most of what Jesus would do is impossible for us. Because Jesus is God. Jesus is Savior. Don't attempt to do what Jesus would do, but instead remember what Jesus has done. Put your focus there. That will calm your anxiety. That will calm the wind and the waves. Look at Matthew's gospel. This story shows up in the 14th chapter of Matthew's gospel. The disciples know Jesus by this point. So who is it that the disciples have seen cure the incurable and cast out every demon? Jesus. Who is it that they've already seen calm the winds and the waves in a previous storm? Jesus. Who is it that the disciples have seen feed 5,000 people with a few fish and a couple of loaves? Jesus. Who is it that raised a little girl from the dead in front of the disciples? Jesus. And who is it that they think they see walking toward them on the water? A ghost. Come on, a ghost. Weber goes on to preach in more colorful language than I will use right now. Not one of those miracles the disciples witnessed was performed by a darn ghost. They're terrible forgetters, the disciples. And so are we. So are we. It's why we need each other. It's why we're in this boat together. To remember. To go where we are sent together. And to remember what God has already done.